You're listening to Modern Marketing, a podcast brought to you by Influicity. At Influicity, we build brand communities that drive revenue. Learn more at Influicity.com. On today's episode, Influicity Director of Client Strategy Ben Albert speaks with Ian McDonald, CMO at AutoTrader.
All right, Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ben. Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you go ahead and share your first insight?
I will. So I guess if it's okay, it's almost kind of more than an insight. There is a kind of an insight from my career within it, but the subject that I wanted to kind of bring up first of all was around ad fraud. So specifically, digital ad fraud. So up until about 18 months ago, as a senior client-side marketer, I used to think I was aware of ad fraud. I knew it happened, wasn't too familiar with the extent of it. But, you know, I would look at the industry report saying it's less than 1% of spend and things like this. You know, you trust the platforms, trust the agencies you're working with. And, you know, I knew it was there, but I didn't think it was something that I needed to spend sort of too much time worrying about. Now, what I've kind of learned since then, I've been on my own journey of discovery, speaking to different industry experts. You know, I've been consuming a lot of content around this kind of stuff, learning more about it. And I'm far from an expert, but I do think it's useful to bring this up and something for your audience to kind of maybe think about. Some of them may be very leaning forward and they're already doing all the right things, great. But based on a lot of the surveys that I've been looking at, a recent survey, only 23% of senior client-side marketers are concerned about digital ad fraud. So I used to be in the 77% and now I'm in the 23%. So the reason I'm bringing it up is that, you know, maybe we can get a few more folks to kind of just be thinking about ad fraud as well. In a basic sense, I guess, you know, I'm sure everyone is aware, but, you know, digital ad fraud, it's basically any time where your ad dollars are being used to serve ads either to a place you don't intend or to an entity you don't intend, such as a bot rather than a human. And there's so many different tactics that they use to do this, but it's a huge industry. So a recent report was saying that globally in 2023, they estimate the amount of advertising spend lost to fraud was $84 billion USD, which is obviously absolutely gigantic and just illustrates how much of a bigger problem it is than perhaps I thought certainly 18 months ago, and maybe that 77% of marketers think. And when you zoom right out, if you look at, certainly in North America, if you look at the penetration of internet and kind of usage of the internet among adults, since about 2014, it's kind of plateaued. Like the 2000s are really ramped up. It's been around sort of 90% and, you know, a few percentage points gains since about 2014. But total digital ad spend has quadrupled since then. It's quadrupled, whereas the sort of available eyeballs has kind of plateaued. It's grown a little bit, but it's plateaued, with the exception of over 65s, which has grown about 20%. But that in itself kind of tells you it can't be that there's that many more ad formats being created. It can't be that there's that many more ads being served in a session to justify that kind of increase in spend. So part of it, but certainly part of it, is the massive increase in the amount of ad fraud that's going on. So I won't, as I say, I'm not an expert and I won't get into kind of giving too much advice around this topic, but I think it's something that people, senior marketers, definitely need to be paying more attention to, asking the right questions, talking to your own teams in-house, talking to platforms and agencies and vendors and asking them how they are helping you to make sure that your ad dollars are actually being spent on the audience that you want to reach and true actions. This is the other thing that I've learned, was that historically I thought it was about bots and fake clicks and, you know, pursuing cheap CPC will run you into some trouble. Now I'm learning that bots these days, they can scrape real email addresses from the internet and they can fill out lead forms by themselves. So you start trying to optimize towards, you know, deeper funnel outcomes, the bots can do that too. Whatever gets the kind of malicious publisher of the original website paid, the bot can do. I think almost maybe with the exception of kind of e-commerce and buying stuff. So the problem is far deeper, more nuanced and larger than certainly I ever thought it was. And so that's something I wanted to bring up. And there's a few things that kind of I've been, you know, looking at and trying to do over the past few months that may be helpful for people to kind of think about. The first thing is that in my research and many others, a lot of this ad fraud is happening where you have an audience extension or an audience network going on. So you think about the Facebook audience network. Google has it too. TikTok has theirs. This is the amount of, if you use an independent fraud tool, which is something else that I would kind of recommend, is finding an independent fraud tool, not via the agency or not the platform itself, marking their own homework. Try and find an independent tool that you can work with to kind of monitor where your ads are being placed, who's seeing them, and also the traffic that's coming from those ads to your own site. You know, is it human and what activity is it taking? But when you do that, you start to see that in some cases, 90% or more of the ads are going, of the spend is going towards ad fraud on those networks. So it's worth really taking a close look and thinking about, do you really want to be in those audience networks, or do you want to kind of keep the dollars within more of a walled garden where the fraud tends to be less, certainly, you know, in the case of Facebook. And one person, you know, if I may, that I would just kind of plug, who's a bit of an expert in this space, and certainly he's been a big part of my education, is Dr. Augustine Fu. So he's an ex-digital marketer of some years back, but he's done fantastic work. He has his own kind of tools and things like that, but he really is a voice in the industry for trying to highlight the problem here and try and help advertisers make sure that as much of their advertising spend as possible is actually going to the outcomes that they want. So he's someone that's well worth following on LinkedIn as a place to start, I guess, for some education around the issue.
One metric that you just hit me with here that is sticking out is that 77% of marketers aren't concerned. Mm. Why would you say that is? Lack of education, don't actually care to begin with. Why is this the case that such a large percentage of marketers today really are not paying enough attention to what, quite frankly, is a massive, massive, you mentioned it, $84 billion industry, really?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I guess, you know, we can only kind of speculate, but I would think it's probably a combination of things. I mean, I can speak for myself that in my case, it's probably related to trust. You know, you trust. There's certainly like the bigger players like Google and stuff. There's an element of trust there. They say they're doing things for ad fraud. You can see what they're doing. Okay. There's trusted agencies and things. As a client-side marketer, you especially if you're working with a media agency, you tend to look to them to say, you're making sure that my spend is working, right? Like, because you've got your own stuff to deal with over on the client side. So I think being positive about it, I'd say it's probably overly trusting might be, yeah, you know, of different players. And the other thing to kind of think about, when you're sitting there as the person who owns that budget, you're ultimately accountable for how that budget performs. You've got to think about which players have which interest at heart. You know what I'm saying? So like in some of these cases, it's kind of, well, you know, if the platform is doing they're marking their own homework, they're the ones that are telling you what's fraud and what's not. But they're taking a cut of every click, and similar with ad tech vendors. You've got to think that through and then think about who you should trust or who you want to trust. And maybe it's like a trust but verify type situation. So I think there's that element. But then also to be a little more pessimistic about it, you know, I think frankly, and maybe this goes more to sort of the CEO and kind of more the board of companies, you know, if you're looking at the wrong metrics and if you are targeting marketers on the wrong metrics, for example, clicks, or like, you know, you've done a good job if you can get the cost per click as low as possible, you're not incentivizing them to do the difficult thing,
right?
And be transparent and say, yeah, but you know, I could get you 2 cents cost per click, but it's bots. Because if you pressure them too much in that way, then, you know, I would think they are more likely to turn a more of a blind eye towards the fact there's some fraud going on. So it's kind of, they're the two main things I would think. It's not that people don't care. I think it's that either they're kind of under a lot of pressure and they're incentivized to look the other way, or they're just overly trusting.
I think these are two massive things to sort of analyze for all organizations, trust and incentives.
Absolutely.
And before the mics turned on, we were talking a little bit about becoming a T-shaped marketer. Can you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, happy to. So this is kind of something that I've seen other people sort of write about this so it's not a completely unique thought, but I think it's worth sharing as well, especially, you know, this is something that I talk to younger marketers, people who are, you know, a few years getting started in the game kind of thing. And this is something I talk to them about, which is, there's a couple of things. The first thing is overly specializing in any discipline of marketing can make it quite difficult to go up the ranks in terms of seniority, because as you go up those ranks, you have more and more channels and broader responsibility. And if you're coming from a place of, I am an absolute kind of stone cold expert in paid search marketing, it's really hard if you suddenly have to start, you know, being responsible and accountable for other channels, not just digital. Higher up you go, you've got PR and you've got offline things and all this sort of stuff. So one part of it is not being limited to a specialism for too long and trying to, even if in your role you're limited, in terms of your education, you know, pursuing training and things like that, or it's kind of learning from other people in the department, really try and broaden your experience as quickly as you can in any way that you can. Because as I say, that will help you when you're trying to get to the more kind of senior levels. The other aspect of the T-shape though is that, you know, with the advent of AI, and obviously it's picked up a lot of pace in the last year, but it's been happening for a few years in digital advertising. There's been algorithms and machine learning, and there's been AI going on for a few years. And, you know, one of the things that I've sort of observed is that some of those disciplines that we just talked about, which 5 years ago was a heavy duty 40-hour a week job for a human, is not anymore because of AI. I mean, think about things like Performance Max on Google, you know, the role of sort of, you know, paid search manager or display manager. The AI is doing a lot of the work these days. Obviously, that has some downsides in terms of control and transparency, and, you know, a little worrying related to what we were just talking about on the fraud side of things. But from a human standpoint, it means that being a T-shaped marketer means, you know, my recommendation would be, as quickly as you can, try to get a broad understanding of as many channels as possible. That's the T. And try and specialize in things which, you know, we don't know, but maybe we would think it would be hard for AI to replace in the near future. I'm thinking about things like brand strategy, positioning, you know, segmentation, this kind of thing. Like the kind of the more, unfortunately these days it's considered sort of old school, but it really is the bedrock and foundation of effective marketing. Stuff also that we might not think of, like contract negotiations. It's hard to think of AI sitting opposite someone or building a relationship and negotiating a vendor contract. So trying to cultivate these kind of skills, and this is the kind of the stem of the T, where you go deep, is these things you would think it's going to be hard for AI to replace. And in that way, being a T-shaped marketer, number one, you're kind of a bit more AI proof than you might be if you're doing something which is increasingly being and maybe could be replaced by AI in the coming years. But also, you're getting yourself that breadth so that you can move up in the organization. And in simple terms, it's more believable for us to think about a paid search kind of tactician type person being replaced by AI than it is a CMO or a VP of marketing. It's hard for AI to replicate what humans do in those roles. So that's my recommendation, not just to younger marketers, but all marketers, is to think about that T-shape in terms of your own skill set. And I can't stress highly enough, because it's one of my kind of things about the industry, the marketing industry that we're in, is there's not enough people with formal qualification in marketing. And being formally qualified in strategy and that stem of the T, it sets you apart big time, especially when you're earlier on in your career.
This podcast is brought to you by Influicity. Since 2015, we've been building brand communities that drive revenue. First, we did it through influencers. Then we added podcasts. Today, we work with world-class brands to build, optimize, and run breakthrough programs that create and capture demand. It's time to stop renting your influence and start owning it. Learn more at Influicity.com.
Okay. Future-proof yourself.
That's it.
Have a specialization, but at the same time, analyze what sorts of skill sets, what sorts of things that you can do within the marketing world that will position you to be safe as the advent of AI continues to grow.
That's it. Spot on.
Tell me a little bit about the three levels of leadership. And again, we were speaking about this before we turned the mics on.
Yeah, I shall. So again, it's something, you know, in my career, and probably many of us have experienced this, especially in interview situations. You know, people ask, what does leadership mean to you? What's your style of leadership and this kind of thing? And there's a million different ways to answer that question. And there's different models of different types of leadership. But there's kind of three stages that I kind of divined a few years ago when I was thinking about how I think about leadership. And I found it very easy to remember and easy to understand. So I thought it might be something that's worth sharing with the audience. So the three levels are direction, inspiration, and liberation. And it's helpful that they rhyme. Makes it easy to understand. And one thing to note is that this will differ by individual and by team. When you're in a leadership role, different people will be at different stages, not just of their career, but of their relationship with you as a leader. So in the direction phase, this is about, you know, as a leader, people at this stage, they need direction. They're not either clear or confident enough to be prioritizing on their own or understanding what needs to be done when, or even in some cases, kind of how to approach something. If you're sort of stretching them, you're trying to get them into other areas, they may need heavy direction. And so this is, as the name denotes, it's a directive style of leadership where, yes, you're leading well, but it's very basic. You are telling people what to do and they are doing a pretty good job at it. They're capable. Okay, great. From there, where we want to be building to is what I call kind of the inspiration phase, which is they know how to do the job and you don't need to direct them on every little thing. What you need to do at this point is inspire them to be passionate about the role. And we do this through things like, you know, consistently reinforcing the mission of the brand and this sort of thing. Inspiring people to be the best that they can be, get up in the morning, be proactive, have their own ideas and kind of not be working in a directive way. And then from there, once they're inspired, really that the role of the leader, and this is to me the kind of highest level of the relationship, is liberation, where your role as a leader, it really doesn't become so much about suggesting what they should do, certainly not telling them what to do, or even kind of having to inspire them, that they are professionals who are inspired themselves. It's about blocking and tackling, removing roadblocks for them, ensuring they have the resources they need, the freedom to operate, this kind of thing. And, you know, it's important to note that the relationship can go backwards as well as forwards. And, you know, and I've seen that before where people have been operating in more of an inspired kind of landscape. They have a leader come in who's too prescriptive and directive, and they will regress down to direction. And then people kind of wonder why they're not being proactive or being inspired or come up with their own ideas. It's hard to when you're being told and being overly directed. So it can go both ways. So that's something else to kind of be mindful of. But the way I think about my role as a leader is I'm trying to elevate the people that I lead up that ladder to get them to that point. And you can really feel it when it happens. I've always said, you know, someone gave me some advice when I was starting my career that if you make your boss's life easy, you will go far. Things will go well. And that encompasses everything. Like, it's not just kind of being sycophantic. It's doing your job well, being proactive, having the passion, running it down. We all know, those of us who have been in leadership positions, how that feels when you have someone doing that. It's fantastic. That's how you want everyone to be kind of operating. And likewise, as the chain goes up, everyone in the world has a boss, right? So you also want to be thinking that way about kind of your leader as well. And that is that liberation phase. Like, in the liberation phase, they are making your life easier because great stuff's happening and they're inspired and they're doing it. And they just come to you every now and then for a little bit of guidance or a little bit of help or a little bit of support. But other than that, they are running down the field. And that's where you want to get to, in my opinion.
A lot of it sounds like you've got this three-pronged approach. Equally important within that approach is understanding the individual nuances of each of the individuals on your team. There is no one way does it all. You've got to really be invested in the people to understand what mix of each of three of those is required.
It's huge. Yeah, exactly right. And as I said, even at the individual level, when there's a change of leadership, it resets because it's a relationship that's built between two people. Or one and many people. Yeah. So it's very unique and it's nuanced. But as I say, certainly in my experience, when I've thought of it in that way, I could almost plot where different people are in their journey with me as a leader.
Yeah.
And you can see them moving, you know, shifting between the categories kind of thing. So anyway.
When in your career did this direction, inspiration, liberation thing layer in? You've been a leader for some time. And
yeah.
You've had a long career in marketing as a whole. When did this sort of lightning bolt strike you, per se?
Well, it took me a while, actually. I mean, it was maybe about 6-7 years ago, which would have been around sort of 2016, 2017. At that time, I'd been leading teams, maybe 10 years, but before I kind of sat down and really thought about, because it's like one of these things that, especially if you're sort of a natural leader, and I wouldn't call myself a natural leader, I've had to work at it quite hard, but you do these things and you have these relationships with people. And so I was kind of doing it, I guess, but I suppose what I'd never done is sat down and thought about how would I articulate this as a kind of framework. And so it took me a few years to kind of sit down and actually do that. And this is kind of what I landed on. And as I said, kind of works for me. So I thought it was something worth sharing for other people to think about their own teams, who's where on that ladder.
I'm curious, again, having been a marketer for as long as you have, I'm sure there's a lot of opinions that have evolved and developed along the way. What is perhaps one non-consensus opinion that you have in the world of marketing?
Yes, for sure. So there's actually one that's kind of been in my mind lately. And I'm not sure where I stand on it, but it's definitely noodling away. So I've always seen, like, for the longest time, so I guess you could call it consensus, you cannot run TV creative on online video. You just cannot do that. That is so basic and you would never do that. And that's been the accepted wisdom. And, you know, for years, I sort of understood that. But lately, you know, I've been looking, especially, this is a whole another topic, but the whole kind of the style of TV advertising has changed so much over the last few years, particularly in a post-COVID world. It's much more performance oriented. You see a lot more elements of direct response in TV advertising than you used to. And so I'm starting to think about that. And I'm starting to think, well, if you invest a lot in a campaign platform, you know, in a creative territory, and you're building that through your TV and your out-of-home and all this kind of thing. And I know people aren't suggesting that you abandon the platform on digital, but if you've got an asset that's working in TV, especially considering, I can't remember the stat, but like a huge number of YouTube, for example, impressions are on television sets in the living room now, as opposed to they used to be on phones and, you know, you could argue it's a different screen. So now they're on the TV set in the living room. So how different does it actually need to be to, let's call it linear TV, more traditional TV advertising? And certainly there's some differences, but what I've found in my experience just lately. So one of the classics was, well, you know, YouTube a lot of the time is skippable. So if you're running your kind of 30-second brand spot with the reveal at the end, no good because the first 5 seconds are wasted. Yeah, I can get down with that. But actually, one of the things I've been doing, or we have been doing here since about 2021, is we open our TV spot with the logo. It's okay. It's 3 seconds. We open with the logo, and we have this car door mnemonic thing where it opens and it shows the ad. And we've run testing on that asset, and the brand attribution to, you know, do the users know who this is? It's 97% in the first 2 seconds of our TV ad. They know it's Auto Trader. That's got to be worth something, right? So I look at that asset and I think, okay, well, that would work on YouTube because, yeah, that's it bias or whatever. So non-consensus opinion, I think that as a hard and fast rule, which I see everywhere and I've heard everywhere, I think it's worth sometimes just challenging that rule depending on what your TV creative is. So that would be my kind of non-consensus opinion that I'm noodling at the moment.
Okay. And last one for you. We've just turned the calendar year here. What is a prediction that you have in the world of marketing for 2024?
Yes, that's a great question. So I suppose I'm going to try and avoid the more pedestrian or predictable things like AI, because we've probably all heard enough about that. But, you know, actually, it's somewhat related to the first topic we were talking about. I'm hearing more and more about the ad fraud thing. I'm hearing a lot more marketers are taking money from performance and putting it into brand, and they're getting great results, which is great for us who believe in brand advertising and we believe in the long and the short and all that kind of stuff. It's great for us to see as an industry that we're kind of getting off the addictive cheap clicks and stuff, and we're trying to think a bit more holistically. I absolutely love to see it. But I think that shift, I'm kind of interested in what's going to happen in terms of overall true, as in, you know, it doesn't go to fraud, kind of digital ad spending. And I wonder if we'll start, because that has been, like I said, an absolute tear. It's quadrupled since 2014. And so I think we're going to see more and more dollars flowing back towards, I wouldn't just say offline, but perhaps kind of more longer term effective channels, because it's not just offline, there's other stuff too. And so I think we'll continue to see that as a trend in 24. And I think that the luster of the kind of like the heavy performance, you know, some brands, yeah, back when I was consulting, a lot of the budget going into hardcore short-term cost per click. I think those days are done. And I think we'll see through 24, we'll see more and more brands kind of realizing that and adjusting their spends accordingly.
The pendulum swing back toward the brand side.
Yeah, back towards like true effectiveness and stuff like that. And maybe kind of a little bit less on, because digital was sold, it's completely trackable, and all the dollars flooded there because it's trackable. Finally, we know what's going on. You know, come to find out, actually, that's not exactly what's going on. And, you know, there's the fraud issue, and also kind of, we still see things like click to visit discrepancies and this kind of stuff. It's not quite what was sold, you know, back in the 2000s about accountability. So, yeah, I think a bit of a pendulum swinging to more of a balance is probably what we're going to see in 24.
And do you think the part of the thesis, the reason behind that, is because more of an investment in the brand side will actually help the performance side perform better?
Yes, absolutely, that as well, as well as the ROI of the brand stuff itself. It helps the real performance stuff that humans are seeing. I think as well, like there's been more and more kind of really good, solid kind of academic work by the, you know, different institutions and stuff, marketing institutions. Field and Binet, and, you know, Mark Whitson does a great job of talking about this stuff. And there's more and more consensus in the marketing community that, like, you have to do both. You can't just be focusing on the performance thing. And, you know, all that is cheap CPC is not gold. It's far from it. So I feel like it's gaining so much momentum. You know, even, as I say, kind of younger marketers I speak to these days, they're aware of it. They talk about it. That wasn't the case, for sure. Wasn't the case 5-6 years ago. So there's a number of things kind of coming together, and that's what kind of makes me think that's the trend we're going to see in 24 and beyond.
Looking forward to seeing that play out. Ian, thank you so much for being a guest on the show here.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Modern Marketing. This podcast is brought to you by Influicity, empowering marketers to build customer communities that drive revenue. We create massive demand via social, influencer, content, paid media, and of course, podcast. Learn more at Influicity.com.